Sunday, June 12th at 11 p.m. Sugar My Bowl closes out its celebration of Vision 21 with part one of a conversation with the very versatile drummer Andrew Cyril. Join us as we discuss Andrew Cyril's career up to the point of playing with Cecil Taylor. That's Sunday, June 12th at 11 p.m. right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web.
I want a little sugar in my bowl. I want a little sweetness down in my soul. I could stand some loving. So bad. I feel so funny. I feel so sad. I want a little steam on my clothes. Maybe I can fix things up so they'll go. What's the matter, Daddy? Come on. Save my soul. I need some sugar in my bowl. I ain't fooling. I want some sugar in my bowl.
And you're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. My name's Joyce Jones, and you're listening to Sugar in My Bowl. As stated on the promo, we'll be wrapping up our Vision 21 coverage with part one of a discussion with drummer and percussionist composer Andrew Cyril. And he was with us last time as we talked about Henry Grimes. We're going to start off the program with the way that we ended from the Profound Sound Trio, which features Andrew Cyril on drums, Henry Grimes on bass, and Paul Dunmall on tenor sax or bagpipes. Stay tuned. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, WBAI.org on the web. Sugar in My Bowl continues.
What's the matter, Daddy? Come on, save my soul. I want some sugar in my bowl. I want some sugar in my bowl. Thank you.
Hi, my name's Joyce Jones, and I'm on the line with...
My name is Andrew Cyril.
Andrew Cyril, thank you so much for joining Sugar in My Bowl again.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Joyce.
And I appreciate your spending even more time with us.
Okay, fine. I got it tonight.
Let's start from the beginning. Did you play anything else before drums?
Well, I used to bang on the piano with the house, and I was trying to figure it out. So I never took any lessons, though. No, I never really studied any other instrument.
Do you still play piano as far as using it as a composing tool?
Yes, I do.
Oh, okay. You said you didn't study then, but did you ever pick it up to study now?
Well, you know, I mean, I have some exercise books that I use. I'm not a keyboardist, but I understand the theory. I studied the theory extensively.
Oh, okay. You played in a drum and bugle corps, I understand. Is that what led you to drumming?
Yes, to a large degree. Yeah, that was the entrance for me.
Did you sort of beat upon things at home and and then you went to the drum and bugle corps?
Well, you know, my mother says so, mm-hmm. you know, that I used to bang on things, but, you know, that's a very interesting question, because when I was about, I must have been about 6 or 7, and we used to go up to a place called Wading River in New York. It was like a park, and I remember sitting in a room, and I was doing something. I can't remember what it was, and somebody came in and asked me what I was doing. I think I was playing on something, and the guy asked me that I want to be a musician.
Hmm.
So I said, I don't know, maybe. I might want to play music eventually. And, you know, I was really young. This was actually before I got into drumming. And I kind of remember it vaguely, but what happened was the fellow was a reporter or something like that for a newspaper, and he wrote it up in the newspaper. And I have a copy of the article.
Oh, wow.
Sent it to me. My sister played piano, and she sang. She had voice lessons and violin lessons. But when I came along, the door was shut.
Oh.
So it's a funny story. You know, I tell the story all the time. Well, this is what happened. My mother said that I used to, when I was teething, you know, I used to bite the piano legs.
Oh.
So in due time, you know, what she did was she sold it, or she gave it to a club that she belonged to. So when, you know, I got older and I became a professional, you know, I used to say to my sister, her name was Laura, I said, I sure wish Mommy and Daddy would have given me those music lessons. Yes, I wish they would have, too. Of course, she wasn't into it.
Oh, no.
You know, it was my older sister. See, well, I mean, you know, everybody's not into it. You know,
yeah.
Some people do it and other people don't. She had a lovely voice also. I thought she had a beautiful voice. But, you know, she didn't want to be into music and to play. That's the other part of it. I've met a lot of people like that. You know, I met a doctor on a plane one time. She was an
OBGYN.
Right. You know, we were sitting next to each other just talking to each other. And she said she used to play piano, but then she just decided she didn't want to do it anymore.
Huh.
So she became a doctor. So you can't make people do what they don't want to do.
Well, that's true.
You have to have a real love for it, a dedication for it, and it has to give you something, you know, on a continuing basis that you don't get from anything else. That's why most of us continue playing music, and, you know, we do it with each other. It's not the greatest business in the world, but at the same time, it's something that has a great deal of spiritual value. You see, and when we do it together, it can be heavenly, you know, to some degree, you know, when it's really happening.
Sure.
That's a good reason why we're doing it. Of course, too, it's a business, so, you know, you have to make a living, so you learn, you know, certain things to do to satisfy each other and people.
So I understood there's somebody, what's his name, Eric Gale?
Oh, yes.
That was the first person you pretty much had gigs with? Professional adult gigs, I guess.
No.
Okay.
Well, you see, Eric and I went to high school together, so when I came out of grade school, both of us went to this school called St. John's Prep. It was a preparatory school to St. John's University. So we were in the high school band. And, yes, on occasion, you know, we would play parties, we would play dances, and then sometimes we would just play for people to listen. Not a lot, but we also had this piano player in Brooklyn whose name was Leslie Brathwaite. So we did have a trio. So I do think around that time, see, there were a lot of musicians in Brooklyn, young guys. It was Chris White was there, and It was Lord Bobby. He was like a Calypsonian. And there was another fellow named Boucher. I can't remember what Boucher's first name was. It was Bobby Hamilton, who was a drummer. It was Oscar Trotman, who was a drummer. There was another drummer named Maurice Brown. So there were a lot of young people in the general neighborhood. So on occasion, we would get together, and we'd play, and we'd talk to each other. There was another one named Steve Butler, who was a drummer. And we'd talk about the music. On occasion, I guess, people would cross. In other words, like Leslie would hire Steve, or Steve would hire Leslie, and Eric might play. There was another guy named Jimmy Revis who played alto saxophone. And sometimes we play with the Calypsoni and Lord Bobby. So it was a group of us who kind of knew of each other. Yes, eventually, I guess around that time, we did start making some money on weekends. I used to get a lot of gigs on the weekends, and I'd sit around sometimes on a Wednesday, Thursday, or Friday, and all of a sudden the telephone would ring, and somebody would ask me, would I like to make this gig uptown or downtown or wherever it was. And it was wholesome, not only musically, but it was wholesome financially, too, because I had a lot of afternoons, after-school gigs.
Oh, wow.
And some of those jobs, you know, they would pay you per hour. But on the weekends, I would make sometimes more money than I'd make all week, just doing, you know, one or two gigs.
Wow.
So that was very, very satisfying. And we would get together and we would have some fun, you know, laugh, talk, play the music. And it was just a lot of what was going on, popular music, R&B for the most part. So that's how it worked. And in a sense, too, that's how we began to build our business. So as things progressed, we started meeting some of the older musicians and the musicians who weren't necessarily in the neighborhood. And in Brooklyn, too, there was another young man who I used to work a lot with, and his name was George Braith. We're just still on the scene, saxophone player. And there were a bunch of us. And, you know, we'd call each other for gigs. And in a sense, you know, that's how we learned how to play. And then we began studying music, you know, seriously. You can't just even play parties and gigs without being able to know what to do for people when they wanted certain things. They would want you to play a waltz, or they wanted you to play a polka, if they wanted you to play like some kind of a calypso song, or some kind of a mambo or a cha-cha. You had to learn how to do that, and you'd have to practice it. So we did a lot of that. I remember there was one time I was playing a dance. I can't remember exactly where it was. But Sammy Davis came in, and he came up on the stage. We had no rehearsal or anything, singing a song. And he just started singing it. So we kind of had to know what to do in order to back him up, that he felt comfortable doing what he did. So you learn these things before you get on the stage so you can do what you need to do. I remember also we used to play for a striptease dancers. We played for female impersonators.
Mm-hmm.
So we played songs, you know, like Tequila, etc. Had to learn how to do that kind of stuff. It was fun. It was a job, but it was fun. You know, it was a good job.
Now, you weren't necessarily an adult doing this, were you?
Well, let me put it this way. I guess from around 14, 15, into my adulthood when I could get into clubs at 18.
Oh, okay.
So, you know, it was legal then. But there's a lot of stuff that I did before I was able to go into clubs.
So Brooklyn is your home. You were born in Brooklyn?
Brooklyn is my home.
And your background, well, you come from a Haitian family.
Yes, my mother and father came from Haiti.
That's apparently influenced some parts of your playing.
Well, of course. You hear people speaking Creole, Patois, and some French, et cetera. So, yes, it had to influence me. Mm-hmm. You know, my mother, she never really spoke to us in Creole. She would always speak to us in her English. Any time she would speak to us in Creole was when she got mad. And she stopped using those words, you know. Other than that, you know, we heard some of the music. I used to go to some of the Haitian dances that they would have at this club called the Haitian Alliance. And I used to see this Haitian drummer named Alphonse Sembert playing the hand drum. He played for people like Pearl Primus, who was
the dancer.
The dancer, that's right.
Yes.
Uh-huh. And a few other people. He was a great one. So I used to just look at him. I never thought that I'd be a musician to play drums, because when I saw him, I was supposed to be about 5, 6, 7 years old. And I'd just be running around the place like most 5, 6, 7 year olds. And down the line, I decided that I wanted to do a recording with him, which I did. But by that time, that must have been around 1970, 71, 72, when I did a recording with him and, well, a lot of other famous musicians by that time, or at least they were, young, you might call young lions, people like David S. Ware and Ted Daniel. There was Smith, Lonnie's brother, Lonnie Liston Smith's brother.
Oh, Donald.
Donald Smith, exactly.
Yes.
Donald's on the recording. There was Stafford James, the bass player. And Gene Lee sang on it. There was my sister at that time. She changed her name to Hannah when she got married, Hannah Icon. But her name was Eloise Lofton, and she was a poet. She wrote a book called Jumbish. Very talented young lady. She wrote the book, and she got a lot of accolades from it by people like Amiri Baraka and a few others. She's now a midwife. That's what she does.
This is the same older sister you were talking about before who was singing and playing piano?
No, this is a younger sister. She's younger than I am. As time went on, I began meeting other musicians, you know, from other places. But on Monday nights, they would have jam sessions, so a lot of people would come through. We'll be right back.
So did you spend more time in Harlem than you did in Brooklyn, musically?
Well, not really. I spent more time in Brooklyn because I lived in Brooklyn. There were a lot of clubs in Brooklyn also. But I used to go uptown to Harlem for the jam sessions.
Oh, okay.
I used to take my drums on the train, on the subway, to go uptown and jam. You know, I set them up, and that's what you call love, see?
Mm, yes. Yes, a whole drum kit on the train. Yeah, it's definitely
love.
Yeah,
and there were a lot of guys up there, you know, Ahmed Abdul-Malik. Oh,
yes, you recorded with him.
I recorded with Malik, yes, a little later. Mm-hmm.
Not to sort of move quickly and get to your recording career, I do want to sort of touch on the fact that you wound up attending Juilliard. How was it getting into Juilliard?
Yeah, that was kind of like a surprise to me because actually I was at St. John's University. I was a chemistry major.
Oh.
See, and I was still playing. Actually, I was doing some gigs at night with people like Duke Jordan and Cecil Payne, you know, on the weekends, et cetera. So I had to make a decision as to what I was going to do with my life because it's very difficult to be hanging out at night and then you have 18, 19 credits.
Yeah.
You have to be responsible for in the daytime.
Right.
I remember talking to Eric Gale and Leslie Brathwaite. A lot of times they would talk about a lot of the musicians, you know, who went to the music schools like Manhattan and Juilliard. And, you know, they thought that would be a good thing to get in, to go to. So I remember at St. John's University, they would have talent nights. So it was one night that I decided to play a drum solo. And I played the solo. And then the students, my peers up there, say, hey, if you can play like that, what are you doing in here? So I thought about it. So I said, well, gee, let me try to take the test for Juilliard. And I went up and I took the examination with, there were two actually great drummers who are percussionists, I would say, who were in the more or less classical field. And it was Saul Goodman from the New York Philharmonic. Then there was Morris Goldenberg, who used to play with the Metropolitan Opera and the NBC Orchestra.
Oh, wow.
And both of them, when I went up to take the test, both of them scrutinized me. Next thing I knew, they had accepted me. They said, you know, hey, you can come here.
Oh, my.
So I decided to try it. You know, I told the dean at St. John's University, I said, well, look, you know, I got accepted to Juilliard, and I'm going to go up to try to see what I can do up there, how I like it. So he said, fine. He said, you can go up there, and if you don't like it, you're always welcome back here.
Oh, that's wonderful.
So I went up there, and I never looked back, except, you know, when I had those nightmares about maybe not making any money. So, and oh, voila, there you go.
That's great. What was it like actually attending Juilliard and going through the curriculum and being with fellow students and all of that?
It actually was great because when I first started playing, everything was by ear. I would just listen, I would memorize, you know, certain tunes, and, you know, you learn how to do certain things, and it's an education also.
Mm-hmm.
But the only difference is when the compositions begin to become more complicated, and sometimes, you know, you have to understand how things are put together, and I have to use this term scientifically,
mm-hmm.
so you can get to certain places without too much difficulty. Because sometimes, you know, you can hear something, and then somebody wants you to do it in a particular way, and if you can't read it, then sometimes you can't get to it, you see, and especially when you have compositions that have so many different sections to it, and meter changes and tempo changes and things like that. So it's just like reading a book. You can't memorize everything. You can have some idea of how a book goes, but if you're not one of those people who have photographic memories, then it's difficult to not spend a lot of time trying to get a composition or somebody else's composition to be played well and the way they would like it to be played. So actually, Juilliard was a place that got me again into what they would call the literature and materials of music. So that was the theory.
Hmm.
So you start learning about scales, and you start learning about sight reading, you know, and all the things that go into basic music making from that side of music. And a lot of musicians were up there at the same time when I was there, so we were all learning. And a lot of us were learning like a classical theory to use in jazz, because a lot of people use that. I mean, you know, jazz is a combination of the both. It's a combination of African music and it's a combination of European music.
Right.
So when you go to a place like Juilliard and you begin playing some of those gavottes, et cetera, and begin to play timpani and play pieces by Dvorak, et cetera, and, you know, all of those quote-unquote great composers. So you begin to learn information that you can use, you know, in the jazz idiom.
Thank you.
thing in particular. Did you really record with Coleman Hawkins?
Yes, I did.
Oh, wow. How'd that happen?
That was a bit of fortune. And the fortune came when I was doing a recording with the great vibist, Walt Dickerson, and I happened to be in the studio, and some A&R person who worked for Prestige Records, his name was Esmond Edwards.
Oh, yes.
So at the end of one of those sessions, I did about three or four of them with Walt. He asked me, what was I doing on a particular date? And I said, oh, well, I'm open. So he says, well, look, we got a date with Coleman Hawkins, and Charlie Persip can't make it. Would you like to do it? Oh, man, of course. How could I not? And I had never seen Coleman Hawkins or heard him in person. I used to hear him on the radio.
Okay.
So when the day of the date came, there was Coleman Hawkins. He came to the Rudy Van Gelder studio here in Englewood, New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
On the date was Kenny Burrell, the guitar player.
Mm-hmm.
And there was Ron Carter playing bass. And there was a piano player whom I had never seen before, heard. And his name was Ronell Bright. But at that time, he was working with Sarah Vaughan.
Oh, okay.
So the four of us got together, and we didn't have any rehearsals. Just at the date, they decided what tunes they wanted to play. And I was shaking. You know, when I heard him just warming up, walking around the studio, it sounded like it was a foghorn. I mean, the long tones he was playing and the sound, you know, oh, man. You know, because sound is like vibrations in the ear. So it affects you. It's to your eardrums and your body and stuff.
Yes.
So I was just so scared because I was hoping that they didn't send me home. That, you know, like he would say, oh, I can't play with this guy. You know, he just doesn't do this, that, or the other. Because I must have been about, what, 20 or 21. And he never said a word.
Oh.
He just played. I played. He let me do what I thought that I should be doing. And he played. And nobody else said anything either.
Oh, wow.
You see? Thank you. see, the interesting thing about it is, by that time, from playing all of that other music that I had played in that part of my formative years, I used when I played with Hawk. See, so I mean, I knew how to do a lot of things. What they do is they just sit on the rhythm. If the rhythm is right, you know, they can play.
Right.
That's what happened. See, so again, you know, going back to learning theory, then you can kind of get inside of what it is that they're doing in a more, let's say, intellectual or more digital way. It's not just knowing how certain things go and you apply what's necessary for the music to happen. Like if you play a rumba or something like that, you know how to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But when you learn what they're going to do, how, let's say, compositions are made when they go to the bridge or when they play a tag and all that sort of stuff. So you kind of learn that kind of stuff in school. That's how those things come together. And yes, I mean, it was a fantastic meeting for me, play with Carl Hawkins, and I never played with him again.
Well, that's enough. You know, there's a recorded piece on the planet with you and Coleman Hawkins. So that's a beautiful thing.
The album is called The Hawk Relaxes.
That's right.
You're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Sugar My Bowl is the name of this program. What you're listening to right now is Oud Blues from Ahmed Abdul Malik, or Malik. And this is from a compilation, Jazz Sounds of Africa. It's a 2003 Prestige Records release, originally recorded in 1961. And before that, we heard both selections from The Hawk Relaxes by Coleman Hawkins, a 1961 Prestige Records release. Before this, we heard I'll Never Be the Same. And before that, we heard Moonglow. And the personnel, as mentioned, was Ron Carter on bass, Andrew Cyril on drums, Kenny Burrell on guitar, Ron L. Bright on piano, and, of course, Coleman Hawkins on tenor saxophone. Before that, we heard Meta Musicians Stomp. That is the title cut from the 1978 Black Saint Records release, Andrew Cyril's Black Saint Records release. Andrew Cyril on drums, David S. Ware on tenor sax, Nick D. Geronimo on bass, and Ted Daniels on trumpet. Before that, we heard Maize from Andrew Cyril and the Haitian Fascination. We have Hamia Blewett, whom I saw last night at the Visions Festival, on baritone saxophone, Alex Pascal on acoustic guitar, Lyle Atkinson on double bass, Andrew Cyril on drums, and Fresner Augustine on percussion and vocals on other recordings. Before that, we heard Call Paul, and that is how we ended the program last week as we focused on Henry Grimes. Stay tuned for On the Bandstand with our associate producer Hank Williams, who has recaps of the nights of Vision 21. Each night, he is there right now as I am here working on this show. Stay tuned. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Sugar in My Bowl continues. Thank you.
then I have you're going to play with Ahmed Abdul Malik.
Right.
How did that come about?
We did two. We did, I think it was the music of Ahmed Abdul Malik, and then there was another one after that.
Sounds of Africa?
That's right. Now, here's another coincidence. Malik was also from Brooklyn.
Oh, wow.
So when I used to play at this club called the Turbo Village, he would come in and listen sometime. So then, for some reason, he wanted to form a group. I think this was after he was working with Monk, and he did a lot of things with a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
So he wanted me to be part of it. And he asked me, would I do this recording with him? And yes, of course. You know, we had a couple of rehearsals. And he had it was a beautiful cello player who did, I think it was the first recording with us, the music of Ahmed Abdul Malik, called Caleb Scott. And Caleb was a great cellist. He passed away before his time. You know, it was another one of those sad stories. But however, when we made that recording, and Kalo and Ahmed, it was two of them plus me, it was just beautiful. It was a beautiful situation.
Good evening, jazz fans. This is Hank Williams, and welcome to On the Bandstand for June 12th. This segment features aerial listings of Suge and My Bowl guests so you can see them live. This week's show wraps our coverage of the 21st Vision Festival with the first half of an interview with drummer Andrew Surreal. You can catch him at the Village Vanguard from July 5th through 10th with saxophonist Joe Lovano, and be sure to stop by our blog for extended coverage with reviews, images, and interviews from the Vision Fest. And we have lots more music for you this week, so let's get started. AZA, the exhibit of drummer Will Calhoun's visual art collaboration, is on display at the Casita Maria Center for Arts and Education in the South Bronx until July 21st. You can see a review of the show on our blog. Vibraphonist Roy Ayers joins Talib Kweli at the Blue Note on the 13th. Bassist Bob Cranshaw is at Harlem's Cassandra's Jazz Club on June 14th. Vocalist Renee Marie is at Hunter College's K Playhouse on the 14th for the National Jazz Museum in Harlem's annual benefit concert, and at the Gin Fizz in Harlem on the 15th through 16th. Bassist Christian McBride is at the Blue Note from the 14th through the 19th. Pianist Vijay Iyer is at the Jazz Standard from the 15th through the 19th. Pianist Harold Mayburn is at Smalls on the 15th. Percussionist Steve Kroon is at Smoke on the 15th. Pianist and vocalist Andy Bay is at Mesro from the 17th through the 18th. Poet Sonia Sanchez and saxophonist Gary Bartz are at the Blue Note for an early show on the 18th. Saxophonist Kamasi Washington is at Central Park's Rumsey Playfield for a free summer stage performance on the 18th, and that's part of the Blue Note Jazz Festival. For those of you far north of New York City and at the edge of our listening area, saxophonist Billy Harper leads a quintet at the Falcon in Marlboro, New York on the 19th. Drummer and percussionist Bobby Sanabria is at the Museum of Jewish Heritage with Eugene Marlowe's Heritage Ensemble on the 21st. Vocalist Liz Wright is at Connecticut's Ridgefield Playhouse on the 25th. Finally, the Blue Note Jazz Festival runs throughout the month in venues around New York City, and you can find details on their website. That's all for this week. If you missed anything, full listings are on our blog. Go to sugarinmybowl.org and click the link for the blog, where you'll also find reviews, features, and jazz news. And Suga is spelled S-U-G-A. If you're on Twitter and Facebook, look for us there too. Playlists and audio from this and previous shows are also on the website. And if you like what we do, please help WBAI stay on the air by pledging whatever you can. Consider becoming a WBAI buddy with a monthly pledge. See the Support WBAI link on our website to find out more. This is Hank Williams signing off with our bi-weekly schedule. We're off the air next week, but we'll have updated event listings online and be back on WBAI on Sunday, June 26th. Either way you connect, we'll see you next time on the Bandstand.
Hi, this is Christian McBride, and you're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org on the web.
And then there was another saxophone player named Bilal Abdulrahman. And, yes, there was a guy who worked with Duke Ellington. His name was Dixon. But Malik was supposed to have Eric Dolphy on the gig.
Oh, it was Eric Dixon, actually.
There you go. Eric couldn't make it because Eric had a conflict with another gig. So he got Eric Dixon from Ellington's band. That's how that first recording came about. I'm not sure about the second one, Sounds of Africa, right, because that was so long ago.
Well, I also have Tommy Turrentine playing trumpet.
There you go.
Okay.
Tommy Turrentine, that's right. And Tommy played his butt off on that recording also, you know. He was something else. Of course, Stanley's brother.
Yes.
Stanley's older brother, as a matter of fact. We did that recording, and, you know, it was great. see, a lot of these guys, they were very, very inspirational. They were very supportive. You know, like, for instance, I'd be playing, and Malik would look at me and say, you don't even know who you are, do you? You don't even know who you are. You don't even know who you are yet, do you? And then he hired me. And then, you know, I would get a lot of compliments like that from some of the older guys. And they would warn some of the younger fellas, you know, like, to keep your nose clean, because there was a lot of heroin in the vicinity at that time. And just about every week you hear somebody dying from an overdose.
Wow.
And there was another great fellow whom I met. He was like an older brother, Scobie Stroman.
Yes, I've heard about him.
Yeah. Scobie pulled my coat to a lot of things, you know, was helping me, you know, to just understand the scene. Because, you know, when you're like 17, 18, 19 years old, you can be influenced by so many different people, and some of the older people may not have your best interest at heart. Mm-hmm. You know, they may be thinking about themselves and use some of the younger people, you know, to do some things that are not very good. You would meet a lot of the older guys who would just say, no, don't do this, don't do that. I remember meeting Walter Bishop. I was down at Birdland one night, and I met Bish, and for some reason, I went up to his apartment with him, and he just started schooling me about do's and don'ts of the social situation.
Wow.
And the music. So yeah, I appreciated that, you know, and I'd see Bishop on the scene from time to time, and I always remembered and appreciated, you know, what he said to me, what he told me. See?
Nice. On Sounds of Africa, though, there were two, which sort of leads me to my next question. There were two percussionists, Chief Bey and Montego Joe.
Okay.
How is it that you, and I've seen you play hand percussion on your drum kit, so how,
yeah.
Do you play hand percussion aside from your drum kit?
Well, you know, I'm not what you would call a conga player like Andy Gonzalez or Montego or Mongo Santa Maria. I'm not one of those kind of guys.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, I got certain rhythms in my head.
Mm-hmm.
So all I have to do is I can pull out one conga and find the sound that I want and play the rhythm. Play whatever kind of rhythm that I know, and I can get a sound. Yeah, I can do that. Now, you see, it's interesting. When you start talking about people like Montego Joe, see, again, when you make those calypso gigs, and you need a calypsonian to, you know, make it really authentic or genuine, or, you know, to have the essence.
Right.
So Montego Joe actually came from Montego Bay, Jamaica.
Right.
So that piece of it, you know, knowing Montego, having worked with him. Then I used to hear about Chief Bey from a lot of other musicians, and, you know, Chief Bey, you know, was just what he was,
mm-hmm.
a chief.
Indeed. He played with Art Blakey as well.
Huh? Yeah, Chief Bey did a whole lot of stuff, a lot of different people. So I began playing with Chief Bey in Olatunji's band.
Okay.
He was in that band. Montego Joe was in that band. There was a guy from Guinea, Africa, and that was another story with me and Lachi Kamara.
Oh, yes. Oh, my goodness, yes.
He and I had done something else together. We used to open a show called The Believers. You know, the beauty of blackness was the overriding theme.
Nice.
We had all these opera singers. I mean, these young women, you know, would come out of school being able to sing those parts, soprano, and that's all the things that singers do, you know, male singers, the baritone, bass. So Olaji and I would be part of this show. I had played with Montego, Chief Bey, Lachi Kamara. There was a guy named Garvin Marceau from Philadelphia. There was Stacy Edwards. There was Bobby Crowder. And those guys were heavy hand drum players.
Right.
So when Olatunji put that group together, because Olatunji wanted to show that African music was really formidable, you know, and it had a history of its own.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of people, you know, would say, oh, African music, you know, what's that? They just banging on drums, etc. But Olatunji, and that's another story of how I met him.
And you'll tell me when you're done.
Okay, so when he put that together, he asked me to be part of it. And that's how I met those hand drummers. Now, the interesting thing about it was that I was the only one that was playing the trap set. So I learned a lot of stuff about African music on the trap set, because Olatunji also had horn players working with him. On occasion, Tunji would also have Yusuf Lateef.
Yeah.
So when we would play certain tunes, there was a certain kind of, I guess you might call it a jazz feeling, that was necessary for the music to be what Tunji wanted it to be, because it wasn't just only drums.
Mm-hmm.
See, so he would have these themes, the cymbals in jazz, you know, is another piece of how the music is put together, another sound, you know, that is necessary. And that's another story, too, about cymbal. Just going back to Olatunji, when I was at the Juilliard, something had come around to the school saying that they wanted some musicians to be representative of the United States to go to Puerto Rico. So there were some people from Hungary, students, and they lived at this place called the International House, which was across the street from the old Juilliard up on, I think it was 122nd Street, and right across the street from Riverside Church. And there were some young people also from the Philippines. And then there was Olatunji, who was from Africa. So Olatunji at that time, he was studying political science up at Columbia University. But again, because he was a representative from Africa who really loved his music, you know, being Yoruba, he was one of the people in this group. And there was another person who was in that group also. His name was Roscoe Lee Brown.
Oh, the actor, yes, with the greatest voice.
There you go. So all of us went to Puerto Rico, and it was there that I met Tunji, and then Olatunji started telling me about this group he wanted to put together. So as had come to pass, when he put that group together, I was a part of it. See, so that's how I met all of those other people. I mean, we used to rehearse, you know, quite often. And as a matter of fact, in Olatunji's band, he had a number of people from Sunrod's band.
Oh.
It was John Gilmore. It was Pat Patrick. Marshall Allen on occasion. Danny, I think what Danny's last name.
Danny Ray Thompson.
Danny Thompson, that's right. And I think there was another Danny also. And this was like the band that he had, kind of like back in the, it had to be in the early 60s. So Sun Ra also used to write some of the music that Olatunji played.
Oh, wow.
Give you a lot of him.
This is great. It's like, wow.
Well, I met Sun Ra in another situation. Sun Ra used to hang out with Walt Dickerson. Walt actually lived in Philly, but he would come to New York and stay at the Y and, you know, to try to find gigs, you know, for a few days. Then he'd go back home on the weekend and, you know, see his wife and family. And then he'd come back to New York. So I met Walt through Philly Joe Jones. Billy Joe Jones,
the drummer,
suggested that Walt call me to do his first recording, which is This Is Walt Dickerson. As time went on, Walt and Sun Ra got together as friends, musical associates, and they used to come to my house in the morning, like 9 or 10 o'clock. And I had this old 54 Buick, and then we'd get in and ride uptown and talk about the music and talk about different places. So, you know, those things, you know, those little gems, et cetera, where you get information, you know, from some of the older guys, because they were older than I. And then you process it. You put it in your pipe, and you smoke it. You sprinkle it on your, you know, whatever it is, and you eat it for dinner. So you digest it.
Thank you.
Well, you mentioned when we were talking about Henry Grimes, when you were with us before, you had mentioned Walt Dickerson and playing with him.
Mm-hmm.
And it looks as though you spent quite a bit of time with Walt Dickerson.
Yeah.
And then you wound up going to Cecil Taylor, I take it.
Yeah. The situation with Cecil came about by way of another chance situation. It's just sometimes you happen to be, let's say, in the right place at the right time.
Mm-hmm.
And how I met Cecil was through the trumpet player Ted Curson.
Okay.
And this is how sometimes things work, and you just never know. If you're not afraid, or if you have an opportunity to more or less be adventurous, or, you know, you just want to meet somebody else, you want to say hi, and you know, whatever it is that stimulates you to make a move to do something. That was more or less what happened with Ted. And what happened was that I was playing duet with Leslie Brathwaite, the piano player, as I had mentioned his name before.
Mm-hmm.
I was playing, it was like just a ballroom, and it was in the afternoon, and the place was empty, and whoever it was that was managing the place let Leslie and I go in to play. So when we were playing, Ted Curson and Harold Owsley. Harold was the tenor saxophone player from Chicago. So he and Ted were walking by this ballroom. It was on Willoughby Avenue, Willoughby and, let me see, it must have been Nostrand. And then they heard us playing. So then they came in to see what was going on. So they started talking, and Leslie and I were about to wrap it up anyway. Ted said to me, "Look, I'm going to New York. And I got a rehearsal with this piano player, and you never heard anybody play piano like him before. So he said, you want to come with me and meet him?" This is, his name was Cecil Taylor. I said, "Sure, I'll go." So when we got to the place that Cecil was rehearsing, it was a school called Hartnett, but they also had rehearsal studios there. And Cecil was playing the piano, you know, he was practicing, doing whatever it was that he was doing usually. And Ted introduced him to me and asked him, could I play? So Cecil said, sure. So Ted played whatever he had to do with Cecil, and I started playing. And then Ted left. He had to leave. So then it was just Cecil and I together. So after the rehearsal at that place, you know, we struck up a camaraderie, so to speak. So I said to him, I said, "Look, if you want to play some more, I know of this place uptown called Pig Al." And I had mentioned Pig Al to you before, where they were having these sessions.
Right.
So I said, we perhaps could go up there and do some more playing. So Cecil said, "Yeah, let's go." So we took the train up to Amsterdam Avenue, and I think it was 150, something like that. I can't remember exactly what the cross street was. So I knew the bartender in there because of the sessions that I had been doing. And there was also another piano player who would play up there at night. He would do a solo. His name was Cecil Young. That afternoon, you know, there were a few people sitting at the bar. And I asked the bartender, you know, could Cecil and I play? So he said, sure, go ahead. So I had a snare drum. Cecil sat down at the piano, and we started playing together. And that's how I met Cecil Taylor.
We had been seeing each other on the scene from time to time. And, Cecil liked a lot of the stuff that he had heard me do. Especially, he liked that recording that I did with Ahmed Abdul-Malik.
Okay.
So he sent a message through. I think the guy who wrote the liner notes, his name was Bob Levin. And Bob called me and, you know, told me that Cecil liked what I had done with Ahmed Abdul-Malik and would I like to get together with him. I said, sure, do some more stuff. So that was like, you know, one of the pieces of the attraction that Cecil had for me. And since I had known him, you know, from before, seen each other on the scene. See Cecil, you know, with Sonny Murray, and I was doing the stuff with Walt. I didn't hear Cecil too much with Dennis Charles. I heard the recordings, but I had heard about Cecil going to Newport, you know, to do the gig with Bill Barron, Ted Curson, and I think Dennis Charles was on that gig. I don't know if it was the bass player or not, but sometimes Cecil would play the tunes by Sweet Pea. What's his name?
Billy Strayhorn.
Strayhorn, right. So Cecil would play some of those tunes, the Jump is Jeepin', the Jeep is Jumpin', something like that. And, Cecil, you know, played, you know, some standards, you know, at one time also.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he told me that he used to play solo, you know, at one of those, you know, you have one of those bars or clubs where you have a piano player playing. He did some of that. He told me that he worked with Johnny Hodges. You have a lot of people who are great musicians during a certain period of time, but they don't continue to be classic in terms of name recognition, you know, like Earl Bostick or Louis Jordan.
Right.
Kind of people, because they were really great people during their times. You see, but as some generations move on, some of those periods, you know, are forgotten.
Right.
Until somebody goes and looks it up, or they decide that they want to repeat some of the stuff from the past. And who knows, maybe Louis Jordan stuff might come back.
Hey.
You know, Louis Jordan and his Timpani Five.
Playing with Cecil.
Yeah.
Do you still play with him? Oh, well, whenever he decides to play with people?
Well, I haven't played with Cecil, for years now.
Yeah.
Since we did a recording in Germany for a guy named Jos Gerbers, you know, who used to have this company called FMP Music. And that's another story.
What is that story? It's like you got some good stories.
You see, just like the Vision Festival,
mm-hmm.
in a lot of places, and in this particular place, Germany, when East Germany, and I had West Germany. Well, yeah, there was a lot of things that went on in East Germany also, but there was this one enclave in West Germany. It was right in the middle of East Germany, see? So what would happen is that they would have, like, the Berlin Jazz Festival, and they would have a lot of famous people there, you know, like Stan Kenton and Miles Davis and Sarah Vaughan and, you know, all kinds of people with big names, Eddie Harris, that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But then there were a lot of other musicians who were not part of that scene. Yeah, it's just like the Vision Festival, where you have a lot of musicians who are in town or who are on the scene who don't get an opportunity to express themselves.
Oh.
So they used to have this festival called the FMP Festival, which was called Free Music Production. So you had a lot of musicians, you know, like myself, Richard Teitelbaum, you'd have Irene Schweitzer, you know, you'd have a lot of, you know, musicians from Finland, you know, from other parts of Europe, Austria, you know, who used to come up and play at the Free Music Festival. So these guys, it was a guy, Jos Gerbers, and he had a partner. I can't remember his partner's name right now. But anyway, they used to record a lot of musicians who were good, but never had the opportunity to play at those major festivals like Peter Brotzman and Peter Koval.
Mm-hmm.
So as time went on, wow, Jos Gerbers has all kinds of tapes. I mean, I did one festival with him, and he had three drummers. It was me, Rashid Ali.
Oh, wow.
Tony Oxley.
Wow.
And Charles Gale was there, and Peter Brotzman, and what's his name from England, Evan Parker.
Wow.
And there were three bass players, I think. I don't know if William Parker was there or not. William could have been there. It was William. Yeah, Koval was the other one. And there was the third bass player. It was like a nonet. So you had three drummers, three saxophone players, and three bass players. So what would happen is we'd mix up the nonet. So in other words, maybe two bass players
and a saxophone player would play, or maybe a bass player, two saxophone players, and maybe two drummers might play together. So he recorded a lot of that kind of stuff. But anyway, that was one situation. I remember Cecil wasn't part of that, but I remember he came to one or two of the performances. He happened to be there. Yost would be a partner. They recorded a lot of people, a lot of musicians. And those recordings, you know, are available. But the company kind of went under for some reason. But those recordings exist.
Hmm.
See, they're over there. Yeah, they're German. I mean, I did one, a duet with Bratzmann.
Mm-hmm.
Andrew Cirillo meets Peter Bratzmann in Berlin.
Right.
And I also, there's the one I did with Chikai, a duet that I did with John Chikai.
Oh, okay.
The Academy der Kunst, which means the Academy of Art in German. But that was never released.
Mm.
So Yost has all those tapes. He's got tapes of me and Richard Teitelbaum that, you know, haven't been released. He's got another tape of me, Bratzmann, and Koval, which hasn't been released.
I say, here we go. Somebody holding on to the jewels. Goodness.
Oh, you see, down the line, they'll probably, you know, be available to people like a lot of art is, and, you know, it'll have a certain value because it will be a documentation of what was going on.
Right.
Of what the scene was like after having listened to the music. It's what music does. So anyway, I mean, you know, it's like anything else, like pottery or painting or film or whatever. So you see how things were at a certain period of time. So anyway, Yost decided, I think it was after the wall came down, if I'm not mistaken. He did a concert, and I was part of it with Cecil and a guy named Frankie Brown. That's an interesting name because I think Frankie Brown came from Curacao.
Oh, interesting.
A guitar player, see, a Fender bass, I can't remember exactly what. And then there was Tristan Hunziker, who played cello. So the four of us made this recording. See, and that was the last time I actually played, you know, with Cecil. And I can't tell you exactly what year that was, but it was quite some time ago, at least 10, 15 years maybe.
So what made you move on from Cecil?
Well, you know, I just wanted to do some other things with myself, for myself. Because I worked with Cecil for 11 years straight.
Right.
So I just wanted to do something else. And after that part of the unit broke up, I did a couple of recordings with Jimmy Lyons. And then I decided to do the stuff with the group that I had called Maono, which means feelings in Swahili. You know, I had David Ware and Ted Daniel, and some of those recordings were made with Lyle Atkinson, the bass player. And, you know, that's what happened.
And you had been writing, I guess, composing, and being a leader since, I guess, 71?
Yeah, 70, 71, 72. And then that time, when I came back from Antioch, after we had been down here for a couple of years as artists in residence.
Now, there's a lot I want to talk to you about, so I want to know, could I have a part two with you some other time?
I imagine so. See, this is what's so terrible sometimes, is that you only hear what, let's say, the industry wants you to hear.
Yes.
And to know, you know, about certain musicians.
Right.
But when you begin to go down into the places whereby they're really playing, and they're not playing to be commercial,
mm-hmm.
they're playing to be musicians, to play music.
Right.
And some of that stuff is just phenomenal. And you'll get another show.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
Okay.
You're a great guy.
Yeah. You're a great broadcaster, you know, radio liaison for the people. The world, you know.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Andrew Cirill, for part one.
All right.
All right. Have a good night.
Good night.
You're listening to the closing moments of Sugar in My Bowl. My name's Joyce Jones. Our guest for this evening, drummer, percussionist, composer Andrew Cyril. And what you're listening to right now is Cecil Taylor, Inter-Evening, from Unit Structures. And that has Eddie Gale Stevens Jr. on trumpet, Jimmy Lyons on alto sax, Ken McIntyre on alto sax, oboe and bass clarinet, Cecil Taylor on piano and bells, Henry Grimes on bass, Alan Silva on bass, and Andrew Cyril on drums. And before that, we heard Niggle Fugle, and that is from Cecil Taylor's Student Studies. Cecil Taylor on piano, Andrew Cyril on drums, Jimmy Lyons on altos, and Alvin Silva on bass. And before that, we heard That Is the Desert, Walt Dickerson from Jazz Impressions of Lawrence of Arabia. That's from his 1963 Dauntless Records release. It has Henry Grimes and Ahmed Abdul Malik on bass, and Andrew Cyril on drums, Austin Crowe on piano, and Walt Dickerson on vibes. Before that, we heard Communication from Ahmed Abdul Malik's Sound of Africa. That's a 1962 Prestige Records release. And before that, we heard On the Bandstand with our associate producer, Hank Williams. Stay tuned for La Nueva Alternativa. Coming up next, we'll be back on the 26th, hopefully with part two of Andrew Cyril. Stay tuned. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, WBAI.org on the web. Thank you.
Hello. Bueno, this is Sonia Sanchez. I urge you to give your generous support to listener-sponsored community radio WBAI 99.5 FM in New York.